All right, so today is October 15th, and this is Bio 241. We're going to finish up neurophysiology today, move on to central nervous system. And so I guess we're going to look forward to taking another test, your third test in here, which is going to be neurophysiology, central nervous system, and autonomic nervous system. And it's not going to be next week, so let's tentatively plan on taking it Monday the 27th. All right, so come to class next week, and I'll probably confirm that it's going to be on the 27th, okay? All right, so that's kind of where we stand in the class. All right, so we're going to finish up some neurotransmitters, and I just want to reinforce that you should know that the monoamine neurotransmitters are serotonin, norepinephrine, and dopamine, okay? And we looked at the synapses and how they affect cells, how signal transduction occurs with these kinds of neurotransmitters. And, okay, I forget exactly where we left off, but I just want to say a few things about other kinds of neurotransmitters that you might run into besides the monoamine and acetylcholine. Oh, as a matter of fact, let me go back to monoamine. Okay, norepinephrine. When norepinephrine is used as a neurotransmitter, we call those adrenergic pathways. And when acetylcholine is used, we call those, can anybody remember? Those are cholinergic pathways, right? So cholinergic uses acetylcholine, adrenergic uses norepinephrine. So when we get into the autonomic nervous system, I'm just going to refer to those two types of nerve pathways as either cholinergic or adrenergic. So if you hear cholinergic, what kind of neurotransmitter are you going to think? Acetylcholine. And if it's adrenergic, you're going to just immediately think norepinephrine, right? Okay. Okay, but there can be other kinds of neurotransmitters, like amino acids can be used as neurotransmitters. All right, for instance, glutamate and aspartate are major central nervous system excitatory neurotransmitters. Glycine, on the other hand, is a very important major neurotransmitter used in the central nervous system, but it is inhibitory because it opens chlorine channels. And don't forget, where is chlorine high? Inside the cell or outside the cell? It's high outside, so then a chlorine channel opens up. Chlorine is going to enter the cell. And when it does, is that going to hyperpolarize or depolarize the cell? It's going to hyperpolarize, and therefore it produces an IPSP, or it inhibits that particular neuron. And gamma-aminobutyric acid is the most common neurotransmitter in the brain. It's inhibitory as well. So you might be wondering, well, why do we have excitatory and inhibitory neurotransmitters? And that's because, what's the most important concept probably you'd learn in an anatomy or physiology class? The concept of antagonism, right? So in order for your brain to have precise control over its functioning, there has to be stimulatory as well as inhibitory effects that balance each other out. Okay. Some polypeptide neurotransmitters don't work by changing ion channels, but they actually can change metabolism inside the cell. We call these neuromodulators. They might increase the number of, or the size of synapses between neurons, or the number of synapses between neurons. And if something about a synapse changes, the structure of a synapse changes, it might be easier to pass information. It might be easier to elicit a threshold EPSP the next time around, and so that's what we would call learning. When you exercise certain pathways in the brain so that they are more easily stimulated the next time around, that's what we call learning. And if the structure of the brain changes, we call that neuroplasticity, when the brain actually remodels itself. So most neurons now, we realize, release a classical kind of neurotransmitter as well as a polypeptide neurotransmitter. Okay, some other neurotransmitters that you might be aware of or might hear sometime, substance P is involved in pain pathways. And if we have pain pathways. In order to balance that out, we should have other pathways that produce analgesia, for instance. And those kinds of neurotransmitters are endorphins or enkephalins or dynorphin. And these have the structure of opioids, like heroin. So these endorphins, enkephalins, and dynorphins are what we call endogenous opioids. And they promote analgesia and mediate many placebo effects. So what's a placebo effect? You have some kind of ailment, right? And maybe you go see a physician, and a physician knows that there's no hope no matter what kind of treatment they might prescribe for you, right? There's no understanding of how it's possibly going to help you. But maybe a physician might prescribe a sugar pill for you to take. Okay, and just by the interaction of you with the physician and going through the motion of taking a sugar pill, that might have some beneficial effect on your body, maybe to reduce pain in this particular case. And so the sugar pill isn't reducing the pain, but it's stimulating pathways in your brain that release these natural opioids that will decrease the pain because you're anticipating that reduction in pain. So that's what would be a placebo effect in this particular case. Okay, so many medications work to some degree by this placebo effect. And this effect can be blocked by an antagonist, which is called, it's a class of drugs called naloxone. And another kind of drug would be like Narcan is the trade name for this. All right, so when we would inject, say, Narcan into an addict that's addicted to heroin or an opioid, that would immediately reverse the effects of heroin on that person. Okay, and so that would be used sometimes for recovery. Neuropeptide Y is the most common neuropeptide. It inhibits glutamate in the hippocampus, and it's a powerful stimulant of appetite. So, for instance, this might be important in certain kinds of eating disorders of some kind. Somebody does not want to eat. Maybe we can give them a substance that acts like neuropeptide Y. Or, on the other hand, if somebody has an insatiable appetite, right, maybe there is some way that we could block the action of this particular neuropeptide to help them control their weight. There's another class of neurotransmitters, which are lipids, and we call these endocannabinoids, and they're similar to the active compound that we find in marijuana, tetrahydrocannabinol, and these are really the only lipid neurotransmitters that we know about. They're not stored in vesicles inside a synaptic terminus. But there is a part of a cell that contains a lot of lipids. What part of a cell has a lot of lipids? It doesn't have to be an adipocyte, but any cell. Where would you find lipids in any kind of cell? In the membrane, in the cell membrane, right? The internal part of a membrane that is made up of lipids, namely fatty acids. And those can be converted into these neurotransmitters. And sometimes these are retrograde neurotransmitters. So what is a retrograde neurotransmitter? This is a kind of neurotransmitter that doesn't stimulate the postsynaptic cell, but when it's released from the presynaptic cell, it goes back to the presynaptic cell and binds to something on the presynaptic cell that produces a response in the presynaptic cell. Now, these are new kinds of neurotransmitters that we're just starting to learn something about. And if it's an excitatory kind of pathway, we think that that has something to do with learning. So a retrograde transmitter might go back and increase the excitability of the presynaptic cell, making release of more neurotransmitter likely if it is excited again. And they also stimulate appetite. And then there are some other neurotransmitters that are gaseous neurotransmitters, like nitric oxide and carbon monoxide. They act through not cyclic AMP, but through cyclic GMP as second messengers. And nitric oxide causes smooth muscle to relax. And that's how Viagra works, right? It increases nitric oxide release, and that causes relaxation of smooth muscles in the penis, which causes it to engorge with blood. And in some cases, these gaseous neurotransmitters may also act as retrograde neurotransmitters. But these are all kind of new things to be aware of later on. Okay, synaptic integration. Let's consider some EPSPs. So an EPSP, what would be a nice mechanism for you to think of? How does an EPSP get generated? What happens? What's going to cause an EPSP? Some kind of channel is going to open up. What kind of channel might open up? Yeah, like a ligand-gated channel. And what goes through that channel? What could go through that channel? Oh, calcium might be an okay ion to think of, because calcium is positively charged. Calcium is high on the outside, so when it flows into the cell, it's going to do what to the resting membrane potential? As a positive ion goes inside the cell, does that make the cell more negative or less negative? Less negative. What do we call that? Becoming less negative inside the cell. That's depolarization, right? More classical understanding would be for depolarization when a sodium channel opens, right? And the inside of the cell depolarizes as a result of sodium entering the cell. That's going to produce an EPSP. Okay, so on this diagram, what we see right here is a multipolar neuron, and it's broken down into, or divided into, the axon. And remember, the axon is the sending part of this neuron. The receiving part is the cell body and dendrites over here, because they have different kinds of channels in them. Dendrites and cell bodies have ligand-gated channels, so they will be sensing signaling molecules. And in this axon right here, we don't have ligand-gated channels. What kind of channels do we have in this axon? Just voltage-gated channels, right, for propagation of an action potential. Okay. So here is a presynaptic neuron. Here's the postsynaptic neuron. So here I see a synapse. So this would be probably an example of an axosomatic synapse, and same here and same here. The synapse is actually on the soma of this neuron. And a neurotransmitter is being released by the presynaptic cell, and that opens up, for instance, maybe a sodium channel, and that's going to cause a depolarization. Okay? So now let's look at what this, what these depolarizations look like as we increase the amount of neurotransmitter, excitatory neurotransmitter. So here's the first case. The length of this arrow right here represents the amount of neurotransmitter released at one of these synapses. All right, so with a small amount of neurotransmitter, that opens up a relatively small number of sodium channels, which produces a relatively small stimulus, or EPSP. Right? And if we increase the amount of excitatory neurotransmitter right at this location, that's going to produce a greater potential change, a greater depolarization. Right? But in these two cases, are these threshold or sub-threshold stimuli? They're sub-threshold because they didn't reach minus 50 millivolts right here, so that's not going to cause an action potential by the time it reaches the trigger zone here. All right, but if there's a lot of neurotransmitter released that produces a very large EPSP, so that by the time it reaches the trigger zone, it reaches threshold, and that will trigger an action potential down this axon right here. Okay, so EPSPs, or these graded potentials right here, and in particular, EPSPs cause depolarizations. They are excitatory. They have no refractory period, so that if we were to stimulate here and here at the same time, then EPSPs will add together. They will summate. All right. The other thing that you should be aware of is if there is an EPSP that's generated way out here on a dendrite, as it flows down the dendrite through the cell body to this trigger zone, it will decrease in amplitude. It will fade away. Right? So graded potentials travel with decrement over the neuron. But what about an action potential without decrement, right? Okay. All right, so spatial summation. So I went back to this slide again. Now, can action potentials summate together? What can you tell me about an action potential? They're always going to be the same. And there's a refractory period so that once an action potential is triggered, you can't elicit another action potential until after the first one disappears because of the refractory periods. So action potentials can never add together because you can only have one action potential at a time. Okay, as opposed to these graded potentials. And we're still just looking at excitatory postsynaptic potentials, not inhibitory. So here we see two presynaptic neurons that are acting on this one postsynaptic neuron. And let's consider two particular examples, two different cases. In the first case, only neuron number one is stimulated, and it's going to release excitatory neurotransmitter, which is going to produce an EPSP. All right, but what can you tell me about this EPSP? It is? Will it cause an action potential, for instance? No, because it is subthreshold, right? It's a subthreshold stimulus. All right, and then it's going to fade away. All right, now the second case over here, let's excite both of these presynaptic neurons. So they both release excitatory neurotransmitter. Number one releases the same amount, and number two releases some almost at the same time. So these graded potentials reach the axon hillock at about the same time. All right, and guess what happens to them? They can add together. They can build on each other. So they can what we call summate. So ESP from neuron number one is subthreshold. The ESP from neuron number two is subthreshold. But if they're issued at the same time, they can add together to produce what? A threshold stimulus. Because graded potentials can summate. Action potentials can't, but graded potentials can. Okay. Before it fades away. Temporal summation is just another kind of summation. This occurs because EPSPs that occur closely in time can also sum before they fade away. So, for instance, if the frequency of action potentials, well, let's take number one over here. If the frequency of action potentials is sufficiently fast, producing a very rapid number of EPSPs, what's going to happen to this membrane voltage? It's going to depolarize, but before it repolarizes, if there's another action potential, it's going to depolarize some more, right? And in that particular case, it may reach threshold. So in temporal summation, we might have a number of EPSPs that add together to reach a threshold stimulus. Okay, so we have both spatial summation and temporal summation. When we repeatedly use a synapse, sometimes we can increase or sometimes we can decrease the ease of transmission across the synapse. So this is either called synaptic facilitation or synaptic depression. All right, high frequency stimulation often causes enhanced excitability across the synapse. And of course, this is what can be used to explain learning. Right, if we use a synapse, if that synapse now makes more neurotransmitter and it stores more neurotransmitter in synaptic vesicles and the postsynaptic membrane incorporates more ligand-gated channels, then with smaller and smaller levels of stimulation, it can cause greater and greater levels of graded potentials on the postsynaptic membrane. And so that's just one theory for learning. And it's something that has many implications, actually, in how we like to practice medicine. And that's because of all the things that the brain does, the thing that it likes to do the most, actually, is learn things. And once you experience a certain kind of stimulus, the brain becomes sensitive to it, and it appreciates that stimulus to a higher degree the second time. and even a higher degree the third time, because it's easier for synaptic transmission to occur. All right, so what does that mean in terms of clinical practice? Well, for instance, you're probably familiar with a condition called epilepsy. And epilepsy is when a certain part of the brain depolarizes, and that depolarization travels all over the whole brain, the surface of the brain, causing parts of the brain that control motor activity to send commands to muscles to contract, which will produce convulsions. And the way we need to treat epilepsy is very aggressively at the beginning, okay? Because as the brain experiences how to produce a convulsion, it is also learning how to produce that convulsion. So the best way to prevent further epileptic seizures is to give drugs to somebody that will stop the second and third epileptic seizure from happening. Because if somebody experiences sequential episodes of epilepsy, their brain is actually learning to produce those seizures and can do so much more easily at any time. Okay? And there are other diseases like that too that we're beginning to realize. For instance, an affective disorder, clinical depression, we've now learned to treat very aggressively as well from the first onset, because there's just a biochemical reason for depression, and that is attenuation of norepinephrine pathways and serotonin pathways in the brain that aren't working up to speed. And as the brain learns something about depression, then it's easier for the brain to produce that condition again in somebody. So usually the first case of depression is produced by some kind of traumatic event in somebody's life, and subsequent episodes of depression can be triggered by less traumatic events and less traumatic events. And if somebody isn't treated for depression, then they can just reoccur by themselves without some kind of precipitating event. So it's very important to treat a lot of these neurological processes very aggressively at the beginning, because the brain is learning how to produce these different episodes. Okay. Okay, let's talk about different ways that neurons can be inhibited. Okay, they can be inhibited by postsynaptic or by a presynaptic mechanism. All right, so if we look at this slide over here, okay, GABA and glycine produce inhibitory postsynaptic potentials. And, of course, if we add an inhibitory postsynaptic potential with an excitatory, what do we get? They cancel out, because one is going to cause depolarization, the other is going to cause hyperpolarization, and they cancel each other out. And when that happens, then it makes reaching threshold much more difficult. Okay, so postsynaptic inhibition occurs where? After the synapse on the dendrite or the cell body, where we have to have two neurons. One is releasing an excitatory neurotransmitter, and neuron number two is releasing a inhibitory neurotransmitter. So one is going to cause an IPSP and the other is going to cause an EPSP, and by the time they reach the axon hillock, okay, then these two are going to cancel out just due to spatial summation. And of course then here's the threshold potential. All right, presynaptic inhibition occurs when one neuron synapses onto the axon or the bouton of another neuron, inhibiting the release of neurotransmitters. So in this first case over here for postsynaptic, both neurons are releasing just a proper amount of neurotransmitter, but that's not the case for presynaptic inhibition. So let's take a look at this slide. So here we have a nice multipolar neuron, and we see some synapses on the cell body, and I see a synapse here on a dendrite. In anatomy, you learned what these things are called. This is an axosomatic synapse, because it's from an axon to the cell body or soma of a neuron. And the same for this one. This would be an axosomatic. But this one right here is an axodendritic, because it's on a dendrite. All right, so In this particular case, these neurons right here could be either producing EPSPs or IPSPs, depending on what kind of channels they're opening. But there's another kind of synapse on this diagram. All right, so the presynaptic cells are always in red, and the postsynaptic is this yellow one. Doing good? Okay. All right, well, at least these dark ones here, these dark red ones, are the presynaptic neurons. And let's look at, so these right here might be releasing an inhibitory neurotransmitter on this dendrite, on the soma, on the dendrite. But look at this one right here. Here is a collateral axon, and it is not synapsing on the postsynaptic neuron. Where is it synapsing? It's actually synapsing on an axon of a neighboring neuron. So when this neuron, for instance, is sending an excitatory signal down to this postsynaptic neuron right here, which is going to cause, what, an EPSP, if for whatever reason we have this collateral axon synapsing on this excitatory axon, and if this one is releasing inhibitory neurotransmitter, this can block an action potential right at this location. So the action potential can't move across this area of inhibition. Because what has to happen before this next area on an axon to open up sodium channels? It has to reach threshold. All right, so if for some reason you were to hyperpolarize this region of the axon, that's going to block the transmission of an action potential at this location. And when it's blocked, all right, then it won't release excitatory neurotransmitter. So presynaptic inhibition occurs because of an axoaxonic kind of synapse. All right, so this is an axoaxonic synapse when the first axon is releasing a inhibitory neurotransmitter. All right, so can you see that this is an axoaxonic synapse? Yep, it's not on a dendrite, not on a cell body. And that can block an action potential at this point in time. So that's a little modification to what you learned about action potentials, right? Because we said action potentials proceed from the axon hillock all the way to the axon terminus without decrement. But now you see that we are aware that that can be modulated by an axoaxonic synapse. So that would be presynaptic inhibition. So we're done with this chapter. All right. We should actually have a whole course, a whole semester course on this chapter. Okay. Next chapter, central nervous system. Now, most of this chapter you already know, so I'm probably going to go over it pretty quickly. Okay. Okay, and I'll try to add some salient points so it's not too boring. All right, so don't forget, central nervous system is just composed of the brain and spinal cord. It receives input from sensory neurons, and it can actually integrate many kinds of information from different parts of your body, and it can make a decision, and then it directs its decision out motor neurons. And those motor neurons can go to skeletal muscle if they're a somatic motor neuron, or it can go to cardiac muscle, smooth muscle, and glands if it's an autonomic neuron, right? Okay. And association neurons do the integration of the sensory input and then trigger motor activity. And also association neurons perform learning and memory functions as well in the central nervous system. It's composed of gray and white matter. Gray matter just are what? Unmyelinated parts of a neuron. So white matter is myelinated axons, and that's really the only place where we have myelination, and that is on axons, not on dendrites and cell bodies. And our brain only weighs about 1.5 kilograms out of a 70-kilogram person, but it contains hundreds of billions of neurons, actually 100 billion neurons, and it is highly metabolic. Therefore, it gets a lot of blood flow. 20% of blood flow goes to the brain. okay, because it needs a lot of ATP all the time. The cerebrum is the largest part of the brain, and the cerebrum, when it depolarizes, gives you your perception of reality. And the cerebrum also controls voluntary motion in your body. So it controls skeletal muscles. And of course, let's see what else we have. Okay, so here we have, you know, a number of different lobes, occipital lobe, temporal lobe, parietal and frontal lobe over here. And occipital lobe is important for vision, and the temporal lobe is important for the sense of olfaction as well as hearing. And the parietal lobe over here is important for what we call sensation, for sensation, temperature, pain, vibration on the surface of your body. And the frontal lobe is important because it initiates voluntary motion in your body. So it's the motor cortex. Okay. Between the cerebral hemispheres, we have a large longitudinal fissure. And so the cerebral hemispheres are really separated from each other, but nonetheless they have to coordinate with each other, and the functions of the cerebral hemispheres are different. Signals can pass from one cerebral hemisphere to the other through tracks that go through the corpus callosum. And the tracks that go between the right and left sides of the brain, anybody remember what tracks that go from the right and left sides of the brain are called? Those are called commissural tracts, as opposed to tracts that go up and down in the central nervous system. Those are called projection tracts or projection fibers. And if there are tracts that's sharing information from one lobe of the brain to the other on the same side of the brain, those are just what we call association tracts. So projection go up and down, commissural go right and left, and association pretty much just go anterior-posteriorly. And one of the major commissural tracts, or the structural feature for these commissural tracts, is the corpus callosum. We notice that on the surface of the brain, which is what we call the cerebral cortex, it is highly folded so that this large surface area of the brain can fit in our cranial cavity. So that folding is what we call a convolution. And a convolution has two parts to it. There's the depression, which is what we call a sulcus, and then the raised area is what we call a gyrus. And different gyri in the brain perform different kinds of functions. So the line of demarcation between the frontal lobe and the parietal lobe right here is what we call the central sulcus. It's usually easily identifiable. And the gyrus that is just anterior to the central sulcus is called the precentral gyrus. The gyrus just posterior to the central sulcus is called the postcentral gyrus. All right, and what did we say about the frontal lobe? What was it? What's its function? Motor. It initiates motor activity. And in particular, the precentral gyrus is what we call the motor cortex of the brain. And this one over here in the parietal lobe, that's important for sensation. So this is the primary sensory cortex of the brain. The precentral gyrus is the primary motor cortex of the brain. So motor versus sensory, just on either side of the central sulcus. Okay, I talked about that. Well, let's look at the precentral and postcentral gyrus. And we can see, well, this is the anterior brain. Here's a posterior brain. So this is the parietal lobe. This is the frontal lobe. So parietal lobe is colored in yellow and, no, I'm sorry, the frontal is colored in yellow. The parietal is colored in blue. Okay. And so we said, and the surface of the brain maps out to the surface of your body, of your skin. And notice, irrespective as to whether it's the motor cortex or sensory cortex, the mapping is really the same. So in the longitudinal fissure, in this area right here, right, this is going to correspond to either sensation or control of what part of your body? Yeah, your toes and then your feet, okay? and then your leg. So if we were to stimulate this part of the cortex right here, what would happen? If this is going to either move something in your body or give you the sense of something in your body. So first figure that one out. Okay? It is what? It is the postcentral gyrus. All right, postcentral, blue. So you're going to sense something. Where are you going to sense this particular sensation? On your foot, for instance. Okay? And I don't know, it might be a tickling or it might be a temperature sensation. Okay, it depends on exactly what neurons were stimulated. Right? Even though there was no stimulus applied to your foot, if we cause depolarizations in this part of the brain, that's the reality that you will perceive. All right, but now if we go across the central sulcus and stimulate this part of the brain over here, what's going to happen? Are you going to perceive something or what? We depolarize some neurons in this location, and that's going to cause motor activity in the foot. All right, just like we can produce motor activity in the hand if we stimulate this area over here. All right, but if we stimulate the postcentral gyrus, then you're going to have a sensation in your hand. So this kind of looks like a person, right? And we call that a homunculus. A homunculus is like a little person on the surface of your brain, and it just describes how the surface of your body maps to the surface of your brain. Okay, but don't forget, postcentral is sensory, and the precentral gyrus is motor. And you can see what part of your body has the best motor control. So we're going to look at the precentral gyrus right here. What parts of your body have the greatest surface area in the cerebral cortex, or what part of your body has the most neurons associated with it, which is the same thing as saying the largest surface area. So is it, for instance, your leg right here? Okay. It is what? Your face, right, for articulation, for eating and facial expression. And the second most dense area for control would be your hand. You have a lot of dexterity in your hand. So this is where you have very small motor units. Can you remember what a motor unit is from anatomy? I don't know if they had which textbook you had. But a motor unit is one neuron and all the muscle fibers it controls. So if the motor unit is small, one motor neuron and just maybe one or two motor fibers, you have very fine control over that part of your body. But if the motor unit is large, one neuron and hundreds of muscle fibers, then you have very poor control or dexterity in that part of your body. So these areas right here have very small motor units because you have a lot of control over these parts of your body. And in lab, what part of your body had the best two-point discrimination? I bet most of you didn't do this one. Fingertips, that's close. That's maybe about the second area. Okay. Your lips, actually. Okay, I don't know if you actually did that in lab, but if you were really careful and cleaned off those compasses or pins or whatever you use, you could do that as long as you trusted your lab partner. Okay, so lips have actually the best two-point discrimination because that's where we have the highest density of neurons going through that part of your body. Okay, so don't forget about that little homuncular diagram. Temporal lobe right here contains auditory centers. And so it receives information from the ear. So a lesion in this part of the brain would produce what? Well, a hearing deficit, right? You wouldn't be able to hear something. Okay, the occipital lobe, we said, is important for vision and also helps coordinate eye motion. The insula plays an important role in memory encoding. The insula is deep to the temporal lobe. So it's kind of underneath the parietal lobe and it's deep to the temporal lobe, so we can't see it on this diagram very well. But if we were to reflect the temporal lobe back, we'd see another lobe underneath it over here. All right, and also helps regulate cardiovascular responses to stress. All right, so here we have a cutaway picture of the brain, and we can see a bunch of white areas and then gray areas. What do we have in these white areas here? What are white areas? White areas are are myelinated. What part of a neuron is myelinated? The axon. So these are what we call tracts. So tracts are just myelinated axons in the central nervous system going someplace. And in this region of a cerebral hemisphere, the tracts are either going from one gyrus to another, okay, or one lobe to the other. Those are what we call association tracts. Or they might be going from one hemisphere to the other. What did we call these tracts that are going from one hemisphere to the other? Those are commissural tracts, sharing information. All right, the other thing we see is, of course, the gray matter on the surface of the brain, nerve cell bodies and dendrites, but we also see some gray matter deep inside the brain, and these are the basal nuclei, otherwise known as basal ganglia. It used to be called basal ganglia, but remember, ganglia now, by today's nomenclature, means outside the central nervous system. It's a group of nerve cell bodies and dendrites outside the nervous system. So all textbooks are being rewritten to say that these are the basal nuclei. You don't have to know the different names right here, but you should just know that these are all basal nuclei right here, and they function to control voluntary movement. So you initiate motor activity from the precentral gyrus, and then that information interacts with the basal nuclei. Because one of the characteristics of muscle is, of course, they like to contract. They have just a tonic state of contraction. And for instance, if I want to contract my biceps brachii right here, what has to happen in order for my forearm to flex? More than just a contraction of the biceps. What else has to happen? Okay, something has to happen to the triceps. It has to relax, right? So if the triceps and biceps contract to the same degree at the same time, I can't really move my body, right? I become very rigid. And it's the job of these basal nuclei right here to make sure that you have nice fluid motion in your body so that when you wish a certain muscle group to contract, the antagonistic muscles relax to the proper degree. Not so much maybe that you fall down, but you have nice fluid motion. So if there is an imbalance or a lesion in this area right here, okay, that produces Parkinson's disease, and that gives you tremor, okay, gives you very rigid motion, and you don't have very good coordination of your body. Okay. So that's what the basal nuclei are for. So cerebral lateralization refers to specialization of each of the hemispheres for certain kinds of functions. And this is pretty interesting. Each cerebral hemisphere controls movement on the opposite side of the body. So signals have to cross over. We say decussate over. So the right side of the brain usually controls the left side of the body. And even sensory information coming in on the right periphery goes to the left side of the brain for your appreciation. And of course, the hemispheres communicate with each other through the corpus callosum. So here is just a little diagram that shows some of the functional areas in the cerebrum. All right, so we see olfaction pretty much is the same on either cerebral hemisphere, but speech and writing, okay, is located more in the left cerebral hemisphere and not in the right cerebral hemisphere. Hearing is pretty much the same, right and left. Language comprehension is in the right side. Right? Spatial concepts are appreciated in the right side of the brain, but mathematical abilities are accomplished with what? The left side of the brain. Okay, so the sides of the brain are not exactly equivalent with each other. All right, so the left hemisphere possesses language and analytical abilities. The right hemisphere is best for visual spatial information. But nonetheless, the right side of the brain should know what the left side of the brain is thinking. And in order for that to happen, somebody needs to have a healthy what? What is this right here? That's the corpus callosum that is sharing information, and that's not always guaranteed for people. For instance, where's your ability to perform mathematical calculations? It's over here on the left, okay? So how about if we tell somebody that there are two numbers, and we tell them the numbers 2 and 3. And we tell them in their right ear, because those signals go to the right side of the brain, right? And they might not be able to tell you how to add those two numbers together, right? Because what you hear with the right ear maybe won't be able to get through the corpus callosum to get to the mathematical side of the brain to add those two numbers together. You don't know anybody like that. But it might seem like it sometimes. Okay. So what kind of lesion would produce that kind of anomaly? That would be a lesion in the corpus callosum or the commissural fibers. Okay, so there can be some very strange kinds of behaviors when the right side of the brain can't communicate with the left side. Okay, language is a complicated skill. Of course, in order for you to appreciate language, you need a temporal lobe for hearing. Okay. But a lot of times what you hear is not the information that is conveyed, right? When you interact with people, I'm sure you've heard this before, it's really not what was said, but it is how things are said and what kind of facial expression somebody uses and body language somebody uses when they're communicating information to you, which is real important. So so hearing, auditory information, as well as visual information is passed on to this center right here, which is kind of at the junction of the temporal lobe and the parietal lobe and even the occipital lobe. This is what we call Wernicke's area. Wernicke's area gives you the understanding of language. So it's taking in all that information and integrating it up together. That's Wernicke's area. But now for speech, what is speech? Speech is not sensory, that's a motor function. What part of the brain is responsible for voluntary motor control? That's not parietal lobe, not occipital, not temporal. That's the frontal lobe. And this is the lobe of the brain. We call that Broca's area. This is what initiates speech patterns. Okay? That initiates speech. All right, Broca's area. I need a functional MRI. Okay. And then that shares information with the primary motor cortex, which then sends signals down to the muscles of the face. Limbic system, I think I'm just going to tell you in general that the limbic system is crucial for emotions, for the appreciation of emotions, including aggression, fear, feeding, sex, goal-directed behaviors. Limbic system, this is not an exam figure. Okay, learning and memory. Okay, there are two parts of the brain, the hippocampus and the amygdala, are important for acquiring new memories. And the amygdala is especially important for understanding and appreciating difficult circumstances that produce fear. And the amygdala is especially good at appreciating facial expressions, so that an individual, when they look at somebody's demeanor, facial expression, and body position, can ascertain as to whether or not it's a threatening kind of position. All right, the hippocampus, on the other hand, is for consolidating short memories into long-term memories. So it's important for memory and also for you to appreciate new circumstances. So how can this occur? Well, there's a special kind of receptor system that is involved with what we call long-term potentiation. So when we learn something at the synaptic level, what is happening is that the first action potential, right, is going to cause stimulation of the postsynaptic neuron, but that does something to the synapse so that the second action potential or third action potential, right, has an easier time going across the synapse and eliciting EPSPs in the postsynaptic cell. And here is a receptor system that we're becoming familiar with, and it requires the two different kinds of receptors, a NMDA receptor and an AMPA receptor, so that when a neurotransmitter is released, in this particular case, glutamate. It activates both the AMPA and NMDA receptors, all right? And the NMDA receptor opens up both a sodium and a calcium channel, all right? And somebody also already mentioned that as calcium enters the cell, that depolarizes the cell. But now calcium acts as a signal inside the cell that induces a number of enzymes to produce nitric acid, right? And it also causes to increase the sensitivity in these AMPA receptors. So that if a neurotransmitter glutamate is bound to this receptor again, then it stays open for a longer period of time, thus causing a greater depolarization. Furthermore, this nitric oxide can be released from the postsynaptic cell. It goes back to the presynaptic cell, and it potentiates the effect. So when an action potential comes down to this Bhutan terminology, it releases even more neurotransmitter than the first time. All right, so the second action potential releases more neurotransmitter. And so this is one way that we can understand learning even at the synaptic level. And these kinds of receptors we find a lot of in the hippocampus. And so we think the hippocampus is real important for being able to appreciate new circumstances in our lives or how we can learn. Okay, I talked about that. The hippocampus, along with learning, is important for neurogenesis. We now think that the hippocampus actually contains neural stem cells. What's a stem cell? It's a cell that can become other kinds of cells. It can actually proliferate. It can repopulate neurons in our brain. And the hippocampus releases a factor called BDNF, brain-derived neurotrophic factor. Is that on the next slide? No. Brain-derived neurotrophic factor, which then can stimulate these neural stem cells into proliferation, into replacing brain cells. And in clinical depression, we find that these neural stem cells, right, do not regenerate. And as a result, the hippocampus actually shrinks. And as a result of antidepressant therapy, that can cause the hippocampus to go back to its original size, right? And then we presume then it can go back to its normal function of replacing maybe old and damaged neurons in the brain. So the hippocampus is very important for treating patients with depression. Let's see, the thalamus, all right? The thalamus part of the diencephalon right here. That's just a relay center for sensory information, for somatic sensory information. Where do you appreciate sensory information? What part of the brain? That is the parietal lobe, right? Like the postcentral gyrus. Well, signals can get to the postcentral gyrus only after they synapse in the thalamus. So it's a relay center. So there are synapses in the thalamus which then direct those sensations to the correct part of the postcentral gyrus. The epithalamus is the tissue above the thalamus, contains the choroid plexus and the pineal gland. The pineal gland secretes melatonin, and we think that melatonin is involved in controlling sleep cycles, as well as maybe even reproductive cycles and maybe the onset of puberty in individuals. Okay, and the hypothalamus is below the thalamus, contains many important nuclei. What's a nuclei? What's a nucleus again? It's a group of nerve cell bodies and dendrites someplace in the nervous system, a central nervous system. So here you can see the hypothalamus and the different nuclei. I'm not going to ask you to know the functions of these different nuclei, but I think it's going to be important that you learn a little bit about this by the time we get into the endocrinology chapter. The hypothalamus is the most important structure for maintaining homeostasis in the body because it contains centers that control hunger and thirst as well as body temperature. It helps regulate sleep and emotions, anger and fear, along with the amygdala. And it also controls hormone release from the anterior pituitary. Okay, so there are nuclei that release very minute quantities of hormones that travel via the blood. So it's picked up by one capillary in the hypothalamus. They travel through a blood vessel through the infundibulum. Did you learn what infundibulum was in anatomy? Maybe yes, maybe no, depending. All right, or sometimes we call this the pituitary stalk. And that blood vessel then goes to the anterior pituitary where those hormones are released, and they cause release of even more hormones from the anterior pituitary. We're going to look at a number of those hormones. And the other part of the pituitary gland, you can see, really is an extension of the brain. So the anterior pituitary is made up of glandular tissue. The posterior part is completely different. It's actually made up of neurons, right, which have their cell bodies in the hypothalamus, and the axons move through the infundibulum. And the axon terminus down in the posterior pituitary release two hormones, and those are antidiuretic hormone and oxytocin. So the posterior pituitary releases ADH and oxytocin. And I think you could probably figure out what the effect of antidiuretic hormone is. What does ADH do? Antidiuretic hormone makes you retain fluids, right? Because a diuretic does what? Makes you excrete fluids from your body. All right, and also oxytocin is a smooth muscle stimulant. So that's important during, for instance, parturition and milk letdown reflex, for instance, when nursing an infant. Come from the posterior pituitary. Okay. I don't think I'm going to talk about that. I'm not going to talk about circadian rhythms. The midbrain is pretty interesting. Let's look at where the midbrain is. Okay. So here's spinal cord down over here. Then the brain stem is in this region right here, and that includes the midbrain, which is this thing right here. There are some nuclei in the midbrain. There are a couple bumps. One here, that's the superior colliculus, and one bump down over here, that's the inferior colliculus. These have different functions. I guess maybe I'll stay on that figure. The superior colliculus is important for visual reflexes. For instance, being able to track an object in space. So for instance, if I were to crumple up a piece of paper and throw it up in the room, your eyes would automatically lock onto that piece of paper and then be able to predict where that piece of paper is going to end up. So that if you're in the way, you might be able to get out of the way, or if somebody was paying you millions of dollars to play baseball, you could figure out where the baseball was going and you could run over there and catch it. Right? Even though it has spin or curvature, the ball could curve. All right, so the superior colliculus is important for automatically fixing your gaze on an object in space. All right, so where is that at? That's over here in the brain stem. Now, where do you really appreciate reality? What part of the brain do you appreciate reality? That is in, right, like the parietal lobe, for instance, that's your primary sensory cortex. So information has to reach the cerebral cortex for you to have a perception of what's going on, right? So this superior colliculus right here, right, that superior colliculus doesn't really give you the sense of perception. It just does what? It just locks your eyes onto an object, and then it makes your eyes track that object in space. But that doesn't mean that you really appreciate what you're looking at. Where do you have the appreciation of where you're looking? That's your cerebral cortex. And that was kind of an interesting case, legal case, a couple years ago. There was somebody in Florida, not quite sure exactly what happened to her, but she stopped breathing. And it was for longer than 4 minutes. So what happens to the brain after 4 minutes? It dies, right? And so her cerebral cortex was dead. And even imaging studies just showed that there was just fluid up here in this part of the head. There was no neuronal tissue left. But her brainstem was intact, including the superior colliculus, which is connected to what? A person's eyes. So even though this person had no appreciation what they were looking at, right, when they opened their eyelids, right, and you presented them with visual stimuli, what would their eyes do? It would follow somebody's hand or a pen or something. And when an uneducated person looks at that, what does it look like if somebody's eyes are moving, following an object in front of them? That they're looking at something, right? But actually, the person wasn't really looking at anything because the occipital lobe was completely gone because of that episode where they weren't breathing, right? And as on the basis of that optical tracking, there were people saying, well, you know, that person really isn't brain dead. Because look, they're looking at something. They're appreciating it. They're following it in space. But really, what was the only function? Only the superior colliculus was operating. So it was really kind of a tragedy, I think, to keep somebody alive using that as evidence that they still had cognitive ability. Okay. So it's really, I think, important for you to know a lot of things about the brain. This other lobe down over here, this is the inferior colliculus. It's important for reflexes as well, but not for tracking optical information, but it's for analyzing auditory information or hearing. So for instance, when there is a sound, if I'm standing here and somebody walks in that door, that sound reaches my right ear before my left ear. And because of that, I know that it's on the right side of my person. And it's the inferior colliculus that can temporally justify where those sounds are coming from. Right, so the inferior colliculus localizes sounds. So even with my eyes closed, I can tell if this door over here opens, or this door over here opens up, or a door up over there, or up over there, because it can compare what time those signals reaches the brain, and then you have the sense of where that sound is coming from. Okay, so we have the medulla in the brainstem and the pons over here. And these centers, the medulla and the pons, can control things, autonomic functions, automatic functions like breathing. And they contain the cardioregulatory center and the vasomotor center, which can control heart rate as well as vasoconstriction or vasodilation in blood vessels. And that's very important for controlling blood pressure. All right, so what does vasoconstriction mean in terms of a blood vessel? Does the blood vessel get bigger or smaller? It gets smaller when you vasoconstrict. So just think of a balloon, right? If you have a balloon and you squeeze down on a balloon, does the pressure go up or down? It goes up, right? Same thing for your blood vessels. If your blood vessels vasoconstrict, that's going to increase your blood pressure. If you vasodilate, your blood pressure gets really low and actually could bottom out and you could even lose consciousness. Right? So the vasomotor center is in the medulla and the pons, and the centers for respiration, controlling respiration, are in the medulla and the pons. And when we get to the respiratory chapter, we'll probably talk about some of these things. Okay. The cerebellum. Okay, so here we have the cerebellum, and we learned a lot about control of motor activity already, and motor activity is initiated in the precentral gyrus, and its motor activity is aided by activity of the basal nuclei inside the brain. And there's another important part of the brain, namely the cerebellum, that receives information from your periphery in terms of joint position. So if a joint is bent or if it's straight, and we call that sense proprioception. So there are sensors and joint capsules and tendons that can measure tension in a muscle and position of a joint. So the cerebellum compares what kind of motion that you think you want to undergo, and it compares that information with what is actually happening inside your body. And if there is an error, the cerebellum then adjusts muscle tone, right, so that you can achieve the proper kind of motion or proper kind of tension in a muscle or a tendon or a joint. So the cerebellum is involved in coordinating movements, and it's also important for muscle memory or muscle learning. Reticular activating system is also, it contains a number of nuclei between the pons and even the medulla, and these are reverberating circuits. So what kind of circuit is a reverberating circuit? Anybody have a sense as to what a reverberating circuit is? It has a number of neurons. So here's the cell body, axon, axon terminus. So here is number one. This is going to synapse on a second neuron. So here's number two. And then here might be even a third neuron that's going someplace. But there's a collateral from this third axon that comes back all the way to this first neuron. And so let's just say that this is going to produce an EPSP, and this is going to produce an EPSP over here, and even this synapse right here is going to produce an EPSP. All right, so when this motor neuron stimulates number two, causes a stimulus in motor neuron number two, what happens to motor neuron number one or neuron number one? So excitation goes from one into two, into three, and then three sends that excitation signal where? All the way back to number one. So all you need is one stimulus for number one, and what happens? It gets stimulated repeatedly over and over and over again. So this is a characteristic of the reticular activating system or the reticular formation. And this kind of system, the reverberating system, is what produces the wakeful state in people. All right, so the first thing in the morning, you hear your alarm clock that stimulates this neuron right here. All right, and what happens? It keeps being stimulated, re-stimulated all day long, maintaining your wakeful state. Okay, but that can't go on forever because what happens to these neurons? Well, they fatigue, they get tired. And when that happens, then this, when the system fatigues, then this action potential won't produce an EPSP over here, and then what happens? Well, then you fall asleep. Okay, so then you fall asleep when you get tired as a result of that. Now, if there is a lesion in the reticular activating system, maybe a stroke or something, and this particular neuron gets wiped out or somehow metabolically changed so it doesn't conduct an action potential, what happens to this reverberating system? It breaks down and a person can fall asleep at any time. And that's called narcolepsy. Okay, so even in the middle of the day, like giving a lecture, I could just fall asleep if I had narcolepsy. Okay, not listening to a lecture, but actually giving one. And of course, that would be terrible if I was driving down the 405 freeway or something. Sometimes we know how to treat narcolepsy, and sometimes we just don't even know where the lesion is exactly and how to treat it. Okay, spinal cord, tracts. There are ascending tracts and descending tracts. Ascending tracts are sensory, descending tracts are motor. And information, we said, on one side of the body always crosses over to the opposite side of the brain through some kind of decussations. All right, so for instance, what do I want you to know from this one over here? A pain pathway. A good pain pathway that you should be aware of is the lateral spinal thalamic tract. Lateral spinal thalamic tract. So this might be, I'm not maybe so concerned about the medial lemniscus tract, okay, but the lateral spinal thalamic tract. We see signals, pain signals come in at whatever level of the spinal cord corresponds to that part of your body, and they immediately decussate over through the gray commissure in the spinal cord, and they enter the spinal thalamic tract. And now how do we know that this is a sensory tract? Because it's in the name, spinal thalamic, right? So the first part of the word is the origin of the information, and the second part of this tract, or the second part of the word, determines the destination. All right, so spinal thalamic means it starts in the spine and it goes up to the thalamus. And other than that, you just have to memorize that the lateral spinal thalamic tract is an important pain pathway in the body. But and it is sensory. And you can see that the spinal thalamic tract ends where? Where does it end? In the thalamus, right? Because all signals that go to the cerebral cortex have to synapse in the thalamus, because the thalamus is a relay center for sensory information. Okay, and then, so here is a third order neuron that takes it from the thalamus up to the postcentral gyrus, right? Because that's going to be in the parietal lobe, that's where sensory information is perceived. And these right here are the basal nuclei. And can you see this area of white matter right here? All right, so what do we call these fibers going from the thalamus to the cerebral cortex? Are they commissural fibers or projection or what? Okay. Okay. Notice that the commissural would go from one side of the brain to the other. We don't see that. But they are only going from an inferior level to a superior level, so they're a projection fiber. Okay, so these third order neurons are projection fibers, and of course they're myelinated, so this area right here looks white when we look at it, and this area of the brain we call the internal capsule. So the internal capsule is loaded with these tracts that are going up to the postcentral gyrus. All right, so if you get a lesion in this part of the body, then you're going to have a sensory deficit, depending on exactly which parts of which tracts are being damaged. All right, so spinal tracts, the spinal thalamic tract is ascending or sensory. Descending tract. Okay, descending tracts carry motor activity, and motor activity originates from what, the primary motor cortex that's in the frontal lobe, and it moves down through the internal capsule into the medulla, and some places of the medulla maybe the signals cross over or decussate. And you find that they can go into the cortical spinal tract. All right, so how do you know this is a motor tract? The anterior cortical spinal tract or the lateral cortical spinal tract, how do you know that that's a motor tract and not a sensory tract? Just by nomenclature, because it originates in the cortex, cerebral cortex, and it ends in the spinal cord. So cortical spinal tract is a motor tract. Okay, and I'm not going to talk about the extrapyramidal tract. So that's it for central nervous system. That's, I think, mostly a review of anatomy for you guys. Next time, we're going to look at the autonomic nervous system. A lot of that might be review from anatomy as well, but you know what? I would actually read that chapter before lecture on Monday, okay, because it can be a little confusing at times. So read the chapter ahead of time. And also,
you might want to let them know, remember last semester that we did 9-3, the great from a white radius.
Oh, I'll mention that. I'll mention that in class.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, the rami probably are misdrawn in your book.
Yes.
The rami communicantes. Yeah. Okay. On Blackboard this weekend, I'll put two additional figures, the motor unit figure and the neuromuscular junction. Oh, no, that's a different class. Never mind. Yeah, okay. I'll try to work on that this weekend. Like study questions, like we did for the last test. Yeah. The test is going to have, it's not going to be 6, it's going to be 7, 8, and 9. So we're done with 7, we're done with 8, and we just got to cover 9. Okay.